Using a different kind of recorder. Hopefully this will record as well. We will see. All right, so I've been asked to just tell you that the exams will be graded in the course of the weekend. So they should be available at the beginning of the week from your TAs. They will post the results in the same way as last week and last time. We're now entering the home stretch of the course, part three on democracy. To give you the lay of the land, first part of the course, we examined how the American economy worked. And the central theme of that investigation was that while the capitalist market economy is efficient in many ways and provides jobs and economic growth, it also generates all sorts of important problems, various kinds of inefficiencies, various kinds of harms, which the economy cannot solve on its own. And I argued in conclusion to that section that in one way or another, in order to counteract the problems that are inherently generated by this kind of economic system, we need what is called an affirmative state. We need some way of having the government correct the pathologies that get generated by the spontaneous self-action of markets. They can't just be left up to themselves. That was the kind of central punchline of the first part of the course. The second part of the course, we examined the problem, the values of fairness and questions of inequality, especially economic inequality. That was really the heart of the course, but also racial and gender inequality. And I think, again, the central theme was that the extremely high levels of economic inequality and poverty that exist in the United States pose a very serious challenge to the ideal of fairness as a value. Really contradicts most people's intuitive notion of what would make the world more fair or just. And these problems will not be self-correcting simply if left up to the actions of individuals in the market. If fairness is something you care about, fairness with respect to economic inequality, but also fairness with respect to race and gender, it needs some kind of collective response anchored in our capacity for collective action, which works through the democratic process. So this brings us to democracy. One way of thinking about the course as a whole is the first two parts of the course focus on problems that are generated by the spontaneous actions of individuals and institutions. And this last part of the course examines one of the central instruments we have available for solving these problems, democracy. This is really the only means we have available for solving our collective common problems. Our task then will be to see what this ideal is, what is the ideal of a democratic state, and to what extent does the kind of democracy we have live up to those ideals, and is it capable of solving the kinds of problems which we've outlined in the earlier parts of the course. So the first thing to look at is exactly what do we mean by democracy? What is this ideal? Well, we can begin with what is the kind of simple dictionary definition of democracy. It literally means rule by the people. Demos is the people, ocracy is rule. Democracy is rule by the people. But what does that really mean? What does it really mean when we're trying to explain and elaborate that idea, rule by the people? And in particular, what's the value we care about which would be accomplished by that kind of institution? Why exactly do we care about the people ruling? And to understand this, I think we have to dig a little deeper. We have to go beyond the surface meanings of expressions like rule by the people, government of the people, by the people, for the people, famous triplet that Abraham Lincoln announced. We have to really go behind it and interrogate what the underlying value is. What do we really care about? What's our bottom line? There are many ways you could talk about this. I like to think that the abstract value that's at the core of democracy is what I would call self-determination. I think it's, I didn't reread the chapter in the book. It's possible in the book I use the expression self-governance rather than self-determination to describe this central idea. Those are very close. I now prefer self-determination as a way of talking about what the core bottom line value is. What does that mean? This is how I would define it. So here is a kind of formal statement of what this value of self-determination means. All people should have broadly equal access to the necessary means to participate meaningfully in decisions over things which affect their lives. If something affects your life, you should be able to participate in the decisions that govern that thing that affects your life. This includes both the freedom of individuals to make choices that affect their own lives as separate persons. You should be in control of the things which affect you as a separate person. And it involves your capacity to participate in collective decisions which affect your lives as members of a broader community. Now that's pretty complicated. There's a lot of stuff in that definition. And it joins together under a single heading two ideas which I think people do think of as connected, but often they feel are also in tension. Combines under one heading the notion that you should be in control of your own life, your own fate, by yourself without anybody telling you what to do, so long as those decisions affect you and only you. But when decisions affect you jointly with other people, the decision should be made you jointly with other people. Here's how you can think about this, that there's really two expressions of this value of self-determination. One expression of this value is individual freedom, the capacity to make decisions over your own life, to make your own choices without interference when those choices involve you as a separate person. That's one expression of self-determination, individual freedom. And the second is democracy, your capacity to participate in the effective control over collective choices that affect one's life as a member of a wider society. Individual freedom and collective democracy actually express the same underlying value, not different values. It's the same principle, self-determination. Now that's a little hard to grasp because often, particularly in American society, there's this notion that collective decisions are somehow an infringement on individual freedom. We see there as being a kind of tension between the collectivity and the individual with respect to the exercise of power. American individualism has a kind of organic hostility to the notion of collective decisions. Somehow it's a violation of your individual freedom. Now, of course, it could be. It's not. I'm not saying there could not be circumstances in which decisions made collectively do violate individual freedom. But if it does violate individual freedom, it's violating the central value that unites individual freedom and democracy. That is the value of self-determination. Self-determination basically means people should be able to control their own fate. They should be in control of their own lives, as opposed to having their lives controlled by others. That's what self-determination means. Now, that's a very simple idea if you're Robinson Crusoe living on an island with no other people. and in which your fate is not bound up with the fate of others, in which all choices you make affect you and only you. What it means to be in control of your own fate is pretty simple if you're the only person around. But as soon as your fate, what happens in your life, how well or badly it goes, whether you can put your own life plans into effect, as soon as that depends on your cooperation with other people, on your interactions with other people, it's no longer true. It's impossible. It's not just not true because of institutions. It's logically impossible that your fate depends only upon your choices. It depends upon your interdependent choices with others. And what that means is that in order for you to be in control of your fate, you have to cooperate in making choices with others rather than just make them autonomously as a separate person. It's an illusion that any person could ever be in control of their own fate if they live in social interaction with other people. Freedom and democracy share a common underlying value, self-determination. What differs is the context. Self-determination means your ability to make your own choices for yourself when those choices only affect you. Self-determination means that you have to co-participate in making choices with other people when your choices impact the lives of others. That's what self-determination means. It would mean co-participating in decisions when the things you do affect other people. Co-participating in making decisions, not a felicitous phrase, but what does that mean? It means basically democracy, that you jointly make decisions rather than separately make decisions. But this then poses some really difficult problems, and probably problems that are never resolvable. There's no perfect solution. The central problem is, because of pervasive interdependency, how do you draw the line between decisions that should be left up to the individual to make without consulting with anyone else, and decisions made collectively? Decisions that you're allowed to make just on your own without consulting everyone, we call private decisions. Decisions that have to be made jointly with other people, we call public decisions. And here's the problem. There is no natural boundary between these two. There is no way you can draw that line and say that's just given by the way the world is, as opposed to that's something we have to figure out and decide on together. Let me just give you some examples. And there's many other examples. I'll give you a couple, then I'll ask you to give me some examples of difficult situations for drawing this boundary between decisions that you should be allowed to just make on your own and decisions which you should have to make jointly with other people because it involves their lives and not just yours. Okay, I buy expensive schooling for my children, but this hurts the competitive position of poor children. Now, there's the whole motivation for buying expensive schooling for your children is to give them an advantage in the competitive market, right? That's the whole purpose of it. Now, there's no way you can say that buying expensive education for your children doesn't affect other people. Doesn't just affect your children. Doesn't affect just you. You're making a choice there which affects other people. Should those other people be party to that choice or not? That is, should they be allowed to decide whether you can or cannot buy expensive education for your children? Well, in our society, we say, no, it's nobody's business but yours. But the justification for that cannot be simple self-determination, because it interferes with the self-determination of others. It's a set of decisions which we think, and I probably agree in many ways, that that's a legitimate decision for parents to make. But it's a decision that impinges on the lives of people other than the people party to the decision. And that violates the principle of self-determination. That violates the principle that's embodied in our ideal of both freedom and democracy. I buy a SUV to make driving safer for my family. Well, it only makes driving safer for my family because not everybody has SUVs. And inherently, it makes driving less safe for many other people. When SUVs have accidents with non-SUVs, the people in the tank are much better off than the people in the Prius. It's a decision that may be perfectly reasonable to allow people to make individually, but it's not in any sense a natural private decision. It would be a perfectly reasonable collective decision to say, we do not want to have heavy vehicles on the road because it makes driving more dangerous for people who can't afford those heavy vehicles. I'm not saying that would be a good decision, but it would be a decision that could be justified on democratic grounds that these apparently private decisions affect the lives of people other than the people making the decision. I own a factory and I move it to Mexico to make a higher profit. But this destroys the value of homes of people in the city I left. Okay, that's a... we consider that a private decision, that the owner of a factory has the right, because of our value of private property, to move the factory to Mexico in order to make higher profits. In order to make private profits for the people who just happen to own the factory. Now, as we discussed in our discussions about the market, there are big negative externalities of that decision. It has negative effects on the lives of many other people. The principle of self-determination says that people should be able to participate in decisions which affect their lives. If it only affects them, they should be able to make that decision without anybody else telling them what to do. If it affects other people's lives as well, if you believe in self-determination, they should be able to participate in the decision as well. I should not be able to make decisions that have massive effects on your life, on your lives, without you being co-participants in the decision. Does the decision to move a factory to Mexico violate that principle or not? Some other examples. This is an easy question. What are some other examples of things that we think of as private that do have significant impacts on the lives of other people? Amazing. Out of 150 or so people, not a single person has a thought. Okay, you turn to the person next to you. Come on, talk to each other about it. Come up with some examples. You got 2 minutes to come up with examples. Some examples. Yeah.
Recycling.
Okay, that's a good example. You decide to recycle or not recycle, to not recycle. That decision affects other people. If you decide to recycle, you reduce the cost of landfills that other people benefit from. If you decide not to recycle, you are increasing costs on the society as a whole, on other people, on how to deal with your waste material. Another example. Yeah?
Smoking.
Yeah, so smoking is a really complicated case, actually, smoking. So there's the secondhand smoke idea, which a quarter of people who get lung cancer in the United States, at least the estimates I've seen, never smoked. And some unspecified proportion of those, we don't know because there are other causes of lung cancer besides smoking. Nevertheless, a certain percentage of those, of that 25% got cancer because other people smoked. That's why the rules that say you can only smoke outside, not in rooms now, and at the university, not even in your own private office, those rules should not be viewed as an infringement on the underlying value of individual freedom. It is an infringement on your individual freedom. You can't just do what you want to anymore. But it's not an infringement on the underlying value that freedom represents, because the underlying value is self-determination. And this is a case where self-determination means you shouldn't be able to make that decision autonomously. The complicated thing about smoking is the following. I have a close friend who's a medical ethicist. He's a philosopher who deals with medical and health issues. And he actually said that it would be good public policy to encourage people to smoke and get lung cancer, because smoking, unlike drinking, does not reduce productivity during the bulk of your work life, and it tends to kill people in their late 60s. So if you're a heavy smoker, you die before you collect on your Social Security. And the lifetime health costs of a smoker, because they die younger, is not actually very different from the lifetime health costs of a non-smoker, because they don't live those last 15 or 20 years that the non-smoker lives. So from a public policy, I mean, this is a kind of perverse argument, but it's a perverse argument that I think is a deep one. It's not just a joke. It's a deep one for how we think about these kinds of issues. From a public policy point of view, if all we care about is efficiency, we should encourage people in the bad habits that kill them, you know, around 70, 75 years of age, when they're basically no longer at the heart of their productive years contributing to society, and they represent more the costs that we have for dealing with older people. Well, take that or leave it. It's a nice dinner table conversation point to make, you know, over Thanksgiving. You can say, hey, some wacky professor said that we should encourage smoking because it'll kill everybody off in their early 70s. If you please say that I was kind of putting it in quotes when I when I said it that way. Any other thoughts about this difficult problem, drawing the line between public and private? What about something that you think is important that should remain private, even though it has effects on other people? Are there things? Surely there must be some people with a libertarian kind of bent in the class who feels that lots of things that have big effects on others should still be left up to people individually. Yeah?
Moving to suburbs as opposed to staying in inner cities.
Moving to suburbs as opposed to staying in inner cities. So, yes, I mean, I would agree. I think freedom of mobility is such an important value, and that putting constraints on that so impinge on people's lives that even though moving has these effects on other people, I would agree that that's one place we should draw the line. But to draw the line between allowing people to move where they want and not still means that we should recognize it has effects on other people. And because it has effects on other people, maybe we should try to neutralize the negative parts of those effects. So, for example, if moving from the city to the suburbs leads to a deterioration in the city, then maybe public policy should put extra funds into the city, meaning tax people in the suburbs, to pay for the costs to the people who don't move. So once you recognize that there are these negative effects of your private choices, that becomes a justification for the government interfering, not with your decision to move, because that's seen as a really important private decision, but for the government to intervene with the negative consequences of your moving. And that requires taxing and spending, this horrible couplet that has become so condemned in American society. Any other last contribution to this discussion? Yeah.
What about same-sex marriage?
Same-sex marriage. Yeah, okay. So I mean, I'm sure, even though we haven't done much, I'm sure you aren't surprised that I'm a supporter of same-sex marriage, the rights for people, regardless of sexual orientation, to be absolutely equal. And same-sex marriage is a private act, but it's incorrect to say that it doesn't have consequences for other people. It does have consequences for other people. Changes the culture. It has what you might call an externality on the expectations in the culture. What becomes normal, once it's accepted and becomes normal, then becomes normative. That is, it becomes seen as perfectly okay. Not just statistically normal, but ethically normal. And that's a negative effect for some people. Now, that's a case where I draw the line. I say, yes, that should be a private act. I consider it very much like moving to the suburbs, right? That is, I consider that something that to interfere with is so damaging to self-determination of the individual that even though it interferes with self-determination of others, my judgment is that on balance, that's a form of self-determination that we need to strongly ratify. But again, to say that should not cloud one's eyes to the fact that it does have negative effects for some people. It's why my personal proposal for the same-sex marriage problem is somewhat different from the kind of prevailing liberal one. I think the government should get out of the business of marriage altogether. That there should simply, the government, the state, should not have anything to do with marriage. That should be a strictly private convention that you go to a church or to some civil association and they can marry you. What the state does is simply create civil partnerships. That is, it deals with the property rights and responsibilities and the legal obligations of forming a kind of contract between people. But it doesn't sanctify anything. It simply ratifies a form of agreement. The sanctification, which is what marriage is about, that's done by private parties, meaning churches, civic associations, and other community kinds of associations. That would mean that the state wouldn't be involved in decisions about what is or is not a legal marriage. That convention is already in place in the United States. So, for example, Orthodox rabbis will not perform a marriage between a Jewish person and a non-Jewish person. Now, we would all object to saying the state would make it illegal for Jews to marry non-Jews. I mean, that would be just absurd. Nobody, I mean, virtually no, I think probably nobody, would say yes. Because Orthodox rabbis don't approve of this, we should make it a law. No, the state shouldn't be involved in deciding who can and can't marry. But it's perfectly fine for an Orthodox rabbi to refuse to marry a Jew with a non-Jew. It's perfectly fine for certain other religions to say that in the church they will only marry people of a common faith. But that should not become a law, nor should would anyone support saying we should make it illegal for the Orthodox rabbi to refuse such a marriage. I think it's fine to allow churches and synagogues to organize their affairs along that dimension as they wish. Again, this is a complicated matter of where you draw the distinction between what should be the public authority and what should be the private. And that's the guts of the problem of democracy, drawing that line of demarcation. Drawing the line of demarcation between what kinds of decisions we should make collectively as part of a joint process and what kinds of decisions we should leave up to the individual person. And the point that I just want to keep emphasizing is that that distinction is itself a political distinction. It's not given by nature. It's something you have to figure out, how to draw the line between what's public and what's private. Whoops, didn't do that one yet. So now let's give the more formal definition of democracy. In a democracy, decisions which affect our lives as members of an interdependent community reflect the collective will of equal citizens rather than of powerful elites. In a democracy, those decisions which affect our lives as members of an interdependent community, interdependence is really key there, reflect the collective will of equal citizens rather than of powerful elites. There are two key elements in that definition. One, decisions that affect our lives as members of a community, and second, that these decisions should reflect the collective will of equal citizens. This is really a demanding idea, and it says more than we should simply have periodic elections or basic political rights and freedoms. It says that the institutions should be designed in such a way that the decisions which come out of our government that affect our communities and collective destiny should be made in a way that are subordinated. Those decisions should be subordinated to the collective will of ordinary citizens. That's a pretty complicated idea. That the decisions that come out of these institutions that we call government, those decisions should be subordinated to the collective will of ordinary people. Collective will, that is a murky idea. So anybody who thinks that the will of the people is a simple idea is just bullshitting you. It's a really complicated notion. We all know what an individual will is. We all experience it directly in our lives, having purposes, making choices, figuring out what to do. We know what it means to do that when we do it within our own mind. But what the hell is a collective will? There isn't an entity called a collective which has a brain that thinks and ponders. Collective will is a much more elusive idea than individual will. And yet it's an idea that we have to maintain. We do not want to think of democracy, I would argue, as simply being an aggregation of individual separate wills. Collective decisions are something more than simply aggregating each individual person's ideas taken separately. The notion of collective will implies some process of building a social consensus in which there is some sort of broad agreement on a course of action. The idea of collective will implies that in one way or another there needs to be a public process of deliberation and discussion seeking a broad consensus that in the end is settled by some form of majority rule, but in which that majority rule is the last stage of a process of building collective understanding. Another way of putting this, in a way that we'll encounter in various parts of this section of the course, is that in order for there to be a meaningful collective will, you need an informed and educated public that's engaged in public deliberation. A passive citizenry is incompatible with a meaningful democracy. You know, a citizenry that sits back and does nothing politically except once every 4 years voting, that isn't involved in public deliberation and discussion and in the formation of a collective will, the formation being a process of dialogue and discussion. And by that I don't mean going to big public meetings. I mean talking with family, with friends over water coolers and so on. It just means being involved in the collective life of the society in thinking through the issues that the society faces. Well, this is an issue that we'll be encountering throughout this session, section of the course. How is a collective will formed, and are the obstacles to forming it sufficiently grave as to seriously cripple the democraticness of our democratic institutions? There are two basic ways that a democracy can be limited. So if our definition of democracy is the one which I just offered, just to repeat it one more time, wherever my notes are, here we go. In a democracy, all decisions which affect our lives as members of an interdependent community reflect the collective will of equal citizens rather than of powerful elites. That's democracy. Two ways that democracy, understood in that manner, could be limited. First, the scope of democracy can be limited. Some kinds of decisions which significantly affect our common fate and our collective interests are excluded from public decision making. So one way, if you want to have a restricted democracy, is to say certain things are off the table. You cannot talk about them, even though they have big effects on our collective well-being. If you exclude important domains of decisions from collective deliberation, that's one way of restricting the scope of democracy. And a second way of restricting the scope of democracy is to interfere with the process. Within the existing scope of public decisions, some kinds of citizens have much more power than others to affect those decisions. Democracy can fail because it has a flawed process, and democracy can fail because it has a restricted scope. Two ways that you could say a society which looks democratic has deep flaws. Too restrictive, and the process is flawed. So here's a simple question that directly bears on this. What's wrong with the idea of a wealthy group or organization literally buying votes? I will give you $1,000 if you vote for the candidate I support. Why not have a free market in votes? So from a market point of view, from an ordinary market efficiency point of view, if we had a free market in votes, it would be a Pareto improvement. Remember that obscure term from the beginning of the course? It would be a Pareto improvement, meaning everybody would be better. Nobody's going to be made worse off. You know, if you have a vote and you would rather have $1,000 than make your own choice, I give you $1,000, you're better off. I get your vote, I'm better off. We're both happy. And we haven't affected anybody else, have we? Well, of course, if I do it to enough people, we have affected everybody else. But what is it about buying votes that really seems to get under your skin? I mean, why does that just seem completely unacceptable in a democratic society? What's wrong with it? If it makes a lot of people happier, that's a good thing. Why shouldn't we pass a law saying you can accumulate votes directly? Let's sidestep all the political ads. You know, we spent $6 billion on political ads in this last election cycle. That's a very inefficient way of getting votes. Some people have a lot of money. They really care about the outcome of the election. Why don't we just allow them to buy votes? What's wrong with that? Come on. Somebody must know. Somebody must have an idea. Yeah. Right. So it's really the first part of your answer that's I think getting at it. Even if it didn't contradict what most people would want, it means that a person with a lot of money gets to play a different political game, gets to have a different role in the political system, and gets to influence outcomes simply by their wealth rather than by their ability to persuade people of particular political positions. The democratic ideal is that people enter this system as equal citizens, and that the collective decisions that come out of it are the result of our collective will of equal citizens rather than of powerful elites. And if you could allow people to buy votes straight out, then powerful elites would have a direct ability to buy elections rather than just an indirect ability to buy elections. Two important facts. So I'm calling these facts because I don't think these are in dispute. These are These are just descriptively accurate claims about how the system works. One can then make a judgment, not just a factual claim, as to whether on balance this is a sufficiently harmful or good thing to warrant a change. Fact number one is private power directly makes publicly important decisions in our political economic system. Many decisions that are of momentous importance to society as a whole and have deep public ramifications are made as private decisions by corporations. That is simply indisputable. You may think on balance it's a good thing. That's possible. That is that the efficiency consequences of this may outweigh the negative effects. You may believe that it's a good thing because private property is more important than democracy. That's another principle one could hold. But neither of those interpretations of this fact deny that the fact itself, that private power makes public decisions in the kind of political economy we have. And that's fundamentally a violation of democratic principles and of this underlying value of self-determination. And the second fact is that the private control over resources represented by the first fact pervasively impinges on democratic decision-making over everything else. That's a little more complicated idea. The first one is straightforward. We know corporations make huge, big, important decisions that affect our lives. That is trivial. Second fact, which is what we will be discussing at length, is that this first fact doesn't just affect the decisions that are being made directly by corporations, it affects all other decisions as well. That is, all other collective decisions we make, collective decisions about how much to spend on education, what kind of transportation system to have, how much to spend on health care, and for which kinds of people, all of these sorts of decisions, which are not decisions directly made by corporations, are nevertheless heavily shaped by the decisions that are made privately by powerful, wealthy, private organizations. These are two important facts, which I don't think, when looked at carefully, are controversial. I mean, they may... Sometimes non-controversial facts become controversial because some people don't want to acknowledge the facts. That's a separate matter. But I don't think from a social scientific perspective there's anything particularly controversial about these two facts. Now what I want to do is move on to begin the discussion of some more abstract... You may have thought this is all abstract enough, right? So we're now going to deal with a couple of concepts that Joel Rogers and I develop at length in the introductory chapter on democracy. I'm going to deal with them briefly here, that are kind of general concepts that help us understand a whole variety of aspects of democratic institutions and how they work. These are referred to as... We refer to them as two constraints on democracy. This is our way of kind of sorting out the complexity of how the system works. These we will refer to as the demand constraint and the resource constraint. These are two constraints on how democratic is a democracy. Constraint number one is the demand constraint. Constraint number two is the resource constraint. Those, of course, are just labels to help anchor a set of ideas. The demand constraint refers to restrictions on what people are prepared to demand from the government. So whenever I talk about a demand constraint, I mean constraints on what people voice as political demands. What kinds of things get on the table as a demand? How do we explain the demands that people make? That's the first kind of constraint. And the second kind of constraint is the resource constraint, refers to the different capacities people have for pursuing their political demands, whatever they are. There's a demand constraint, constraints on what gets voiced, what gets demanded in politics, and a resource constraint, what kinds of capacities people have to push whatever it is that they're demanding. Let's look at each of these briefly. Now, this is discussed in some detail and quite, I hope, clearly and carefully in the chapter. The lecture is not a substitute for reading carefully the chapter. I think sometimes in a course like this, because the lectures track the chapters quite closely, which of course shouldn't be a surprise given that we wrote the book based on the lectures that Joel and I had developed over the first 20 years that we taught the course. So it's kind of natural that the book follows the lectures. But there are particular parts of the course, and this would be an example, where because of time constraints, I necessarily will go through some of the ideas in less detail in the lecture than exists in the chapter. And therefore, if you rely entirely on the lecture for your understanding, you're going to miss some of the argument. So this is a case where I encourage you to read the collateral corresponding chapter carefully. So here's the question. Now we're talking about the demand constraint. Let's focus on that briefly. Here's the question that the demand constraint is an answer to. How do we explain the kinds of demands that get raised in the political system? Why is it that most of the time, why do most people limit their political demands to things which are compatible with the interests of business corporations? By and large, most of the time, the political demands that get made in our economy, in our society, are demands that are compatible with the interests of business. That's the question. The basic argument is this. In capitalism, profits provide the motive for investment by competing private firms. And investment is the necessary condition for realizing everybody's economic interests. That's the nature of a capitalist economy, that investments that provide jobs come from private business interests, finding it profitable to make investments. And everybody's interests depends upon a vibrant economy, not just the interests of businessmen. Everybody's interest depends upon successful investment and job creation. And thus, the welfare of everyone depends upon the welfare of capitalists. That's a pretty interesting political situation. If everybody's well-being, even people who are disadvantaged by capitalist firms, but their well-being still depends upon the welfare of capitalists. The rules of the game of a capitalist democracy ensure that, in general, only those political demands get recognized as legitimate if they are compatible with capitalist interests and a good business climate. Now, sometimes, as we've seen in the recent election, there's big debates as to what is, in fact, good for business. But note, in the debate between Obama and Romney in the election, between the Republicans and the Democrats, the debate was not over whether or not policy should be adopted that would be good for business. No one said we should adopt policies that will be harmful to business. The disagreement was over what policies would in fact be beneficial to business. The arguments for stimulus spending were not, we should have more deficits and bigger stimulus because it's bad for business. Nobody said that. The argument was over whether or not, in the short run and the long run, these policies would be good for business. Everybody wants policies that are good for business because everybody wants policies that will promote the creation of jobs and the revitalization of the economy. The disagreement is over the facts of the case, which of these policies will in fact be good for business. No one is raising demands for policies which are harmful to the business climate. This has two big implications for the nature of the kind of political system and how it works. First, the interests of business appear to be general interests rather than special interests. The interests of workers and unions are seen as special interests, whereas the interests of business as a whole are identified as the general interests of the society. The president of General Motors in the 1950s quipped, "What's good for General Motors is good for America." And that was taken not as merely a self-serving statement, but as a factual statement about the tightness of the connection between the interests of business and the general interest. And the second implication of this basic argument about the dependency of everyone's interests on the well-being of capitalism is there's a strong tendency for people to limit their demands to those that are consistent with a good business climate. But before proposing any policy, you have to ask, how does this affect business? This is typically an explicit discussion, not an implicit one, in urban politics. When city governments propose some new project that requires new taxes, the argument is not simply, are people willing to pay these taxes, but rather, will these taxes create a bad business climate? Politicians do not have to ask the question, how does this affect the poor? That is, there's no general rule, no general systematic constraint on the way our politics is organized in which people are forced to ask the question before they raise a political demand, is this good or bad for the poor? No, you don't have to ask that. You may be forced to if people are mobilized, but it's not built into the fabric of the system to ask, is this good for the poor? Whereas it is built into the very nature of the system to ask the question, is this good for business? And that's the heart of the idea of a demand constraint. A demand constraint means that whenever you're raising issues politically, trying to get them on the table for collective deliberation, for what we should do collectively to solve problems, you're constrained to only put things on the table that seem compatible with maintaining a good business climate. That's the demand constraint. Now the resource constraint. This is, I think, a simpler idea. When we think of the way in which powerful and wealthy individuals and organizations influence politics, mostly people are talking about the resource constraint. The basic idea is this. The demand constraint imposes limits on what people are likely to demand, but it doesn't dictate a unique outcome. It just says what's going to be on the table, so to speak, for discussion. The resource constraint helps explain what happens within those limits. Different groups have access to different kinds of resources which they can deploy. They can deploy in political conflicts to influence political outcomes. Individuals and corporations with high income and wealth are able to use those resources effectively to influence political processes. That's the basic core idea of the resource constraint. Once you get demands on the table, different actors and organizations are able to see that their preferred options get more attention and are more likely to pass. And there's all sorts of ways that this happens. Here are some simple examples, and then I want to look at a kind of deeper example, a deeper part of the problem. The simple examples. Well, the simplest example is corruption and bribery. Poor people are not in a position to bribe politicians. Rich people are in the position to bribe politicians. And periodically that blows up as a scandal. It's not legitimate, it's not legal, but it happens all the time. Relatively speaking, the United States has a history of pretty clean government. You know, all governments, even the squeaky cleanest, have occasional examples of corruption and bribery. The United States, on the scale of on the various corruption indexes that get calculated for different countries, we're pretty good with respect to this first issue. We're not a highly corrupt kind of political system in the literal sense. Using the word corruption, not metaphorically, but directly, to what extent are our politicians bought off in the literal sense? That is, they get wads of money delivered in black suitcases. That's not a very prominent part of our political system. The prospects for high-paying jobs after leaving office, however, that is a pretty important issue. The role of lobbies and of networks that are established between wealthy and powerful actors and politicians when they're in office, which include the prospects of very high-paying jobs once you leave office, that is an important part of the way the resource constraint and it works, and it does have a slightly corrupt flavor to it. You know, the fact that Tommy Thompson got million-dollar jobs after being governor and Secretary of Health and Human Services wasn't just a random fact. It would have been jeopardized if he had engaged in policies that were hostile to the interests which later he served in private capacity after leaving office. There's nothing illegal about that. There's nothing illegal about a politician retiring from public office and taking a high-powered, high-paying job as a lobbyist. But there's something unsavory about it. Doesn't feel quite right. And it reflects this resource constraint. Campaign contributions and control over the mass media are other simple and straightforward examples. We'll look at each of those in more detail in subsequent lectures. But there's another aspect of the resource constraint which is more subtle, more difficult to fully understand, and which I think is super important, and which brings us back to our old friend, the free rider problem. So remember the free rider problem. This is a kind of review. The free rider problem is this problem when there's some kind of cooperation between people that's needed, and the cooperation requires spending resources of one sort or another, and the incentives get set up in such a way that people are tempted to be free riders on other people's effort because they'll get the benefits anyway and they figure they don't have to contribute. Free rider problem is pursuing your own interests in a rational way ends up hurting your own interests, not just about those of other people. Remember, that's why it's a problem. It results in collective action failures. One of the examples that I emphasized when we talked about the free rider problem in the economy was the problem of producing public goods. Hope this at least rings bells to most of you. A public good is something which broadly benefits everyone or nearly everyone, and in which the consumption by one person doesn't exclude the consumption by anyone else. So national defense is a good example of a public good. It benefits everyone, and your consumption of national defense, that is, you're being protected, doesn't exclude anybody else from being protected. Public goods have this character that in order to produce them, you need resources, and everybody gets the benefits if they're produced, and therefore you can't really rely very well on just voluntary contributions. Just imagine what the American military budget would be like if it was all dependent on bake sales, so to speak. If the American military simply sent out like NPR, you know, National Public Radio has a pledge drive in which everybody can listen. You don't have to pay to listen to National Public Radio or PBS, but they have these pledge drives and they say, come on, don't be a free rider, don't be a schmuck. You're listening to this, other people are paying, it's your job, you should pay too. And 20% of listeners pay, I think, roughly. Well, just imagine if the military raised its money that way. We don't have taxes to pay for it. It's a public good, and they have a pledge drive twice a year to raise the amount of money needed for battleships. Well, obviously it's not a very good way of financing a military. That's because it's a public good and an expensive public good. Now here's the point. Democracy is a public good. Everyone would rather live in a democracy rather than in a dictatorship. Most people would rather live in a real democracy than a phony democracy, a democracy that's just on the surface, that doesn't have genuine rule by the people. But democracy requires a lot of sustained voluntary contribution of activity to function democratically. It requires lots of effort. And any given person is likely to feel that their own effort isn't going to make much difference, so why bother? Therefore, democracy is inherently plagued by free rider problems. And here's the basic issue. And then I'll show you why this is related to the resource constraint. The basic issue is this. Democracy requires very high levels of energetic voluntary cooperation among people. People have to be willing to join together for political purposes. You can't have a democracy if everybody is passive. Democracy requires people engaged in politics. People have to be willing to join together for political purposes. The free rider problem makes this difficult. However, and this is where the resource constraint comes in, it is easier for wealthy people, people with lots of resources, to overcome the free rider problem. So it's easier for rich people to participate actively in democratic processes than it is for poor people. It's easier for them to overcome the free rider problem. And in particular, it's easier because they can substitute payment for activity. A willingness to pay rather than a willingness to act. For most folks, to participate in democracy in a serious way means they have to be willing to do things. For wealthy people, to participate in democracy means they have to be willing to pay for things. And if you're rich enough, willingness to pay for things doesn't actually diminish your own consumption. If you have enough discretionary income, George Romney has, I forget, 7 houses. That may be 5, I don't remember exactly. It does not, no matter how much he spends on politics, and people in his class spend on politics, it doesn't impinge on their capacity to consume. A willingness to pay is a much weaker threshold for participation than a willingness to act. So why is the free rider problem more difficult for ordinary citizens to overcome? And that difficulty is what constitutes this as part of the resource constraint. Here's the basic inventory. The efficacy of individual action is low for most people. For most people, most of the time, the impact of your own individual action is quite limited. If your own actions make little difference, and if it is costly to participate, why bother participating? That's the classic free rider problem. If you're not going to make much difference, and it's costly to participate, why bother? For very wealthy people, their individual action and money is likely to make a bigger difference, and therefore they are more likely to feel it is worth the trouble to engage in political activities. That is the key underlying structural fact about the situation that people live in. That means that the access to high resources gives advantages not just in the simple way that you have more money to spend, but the access to those resources makes it easier to coordinate your actions with others, that is, to overcome the free rider problem. This brings us to the last topic in this first introductory lecture, which is captured by this kind of strange expression, rational ignorance. Rational ignorance. This is a term invented by political scientists, and it's meant to help us understand why in some cases it's actually rational for people to remain uninformed about things rather than to become informed, and why rational interest, rational ignorance becomes an important weakness of democratic participation for ordinary citizens. Let me just run through the steps of the argument. I think I have just enough time to do this quickly. Probably not enough time to dwell and savor each individual step of the argument, but this is also, again, recounted in the chapter, so you can stop and savor each step of the argument when you read the chapter. Step one. Information is necessary for politics, but good information is costly. That seems a pretty straightforward point. Where do you get really, really cheap information for politics? In the last election campaign, what was the source of the cheapest information? Somebody. Louder. Advertising. Political ads, right? You don't have to expend effort to watch. Well, maybe you do because they're so tedious eventually. But you're sitting watching a television program, you're watching a football game, and in the commercial break you get an ad. It didn't take any special effort to get the information of the ad. That's cheap information. It's unlikely, however, to be good information. Good information is costly. The question that anyone asks about anything, and you know, when deciding whether it's worth investing in something that's costly, are the benefits of good information greater than the costs of acquiring high quality information? For some things, the answer is yes. You know, when you're buying an expensive consumer item, many people decide it is worth the effort to try to find out what are the pros and cons of different options. That's why we have Consumer Reports as a testing organization that looks at the quality of different consumer items. But for most citizens, most of the time, the answer to the question, are the benefits of getting good information worth the costs of acquiring good information in politics, is it worth it? The answer for most people is no. It's not worth the time and effort it would take to really get high quality information. There are two reasons for this. First, the costs for most people are high. Most people don't know how to get good, high quality political information, and therefore for them to do the research and read through the various kinds of reports necessary to have a highly informed understanding of political issues would be very high. But also, the ability of most people to make a political difference using this information is very small. Remember, the costs and benefits depend not just on the cost of acquiring the information, but how much benefit you get from that additional information. If the only way you participate in politics is by casting a vote, and if it's very costly to get good information that might change your vote, because you might make a different choice, most people figure it's not worth the extra effort. Therefore, most people only acquire information that they can get at zero cost. That's the source of most people's political information, is the information that they can get without spending any effort. But zero-cost information is generally of poor quality. The conclusion is it is rational for most people to remain ignorant about political matters. Now, that's the rational ignorance problem as a general problem about politics. The resource constraint then enters into this problem, the problem of rational ignorance, because people with lots of resources are able to individually make a bigger difference in politics, and therefore it's more rational for them to become informed, but also they have the resources to provide the low-quality information for people who are only prepared to get information at zero cost. So the inequalities in access to resources both make people more vulnerable to the rational ignorance problem and enable some people to, in effect, manipulate the political information available to others through the use of their resources. Now, these are the broad ideas and theoretical constraints that are present really in any democratic system. This is true in Sweden and Germany and Britain and France, as well as the United States. The same problem. There's a rational ignorance problem in Germany. Emmanuel is from Germany. There's a lot of rationally ignorant people in Germany as well. The resource constraint and the demand constraint operates there as well as it does here. This is not a distinctively American problem. However, the extent to which these background conditions and background problems play themselves out in a weakened and thin democracy, that does vary across countries. And that depends upon the way the specific institutions we have either intensify or blunt the effects of these processes. And that's the way you should approach this whole section. The demand constraint and the resource constraint, the free rider problem and rational ignorance, these are general problems that would occur in any democratic society. How serious do these actually impact the democraticness of our democracy depends upon the specific rules of the game that we add to these general problems that either intensify them, make them even worse than they need be, or mute them, provide a countervailing set of processes that create more democratic balance. And how that plays itself out, we will see in the course of the next 3.5 weeks. See you next week.